Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we roll into carnival season with Robin Roberts and Leslie Wade, who along with Frank DeCaro are the authors of Downtown Mardi Gras, New Carnival Practices in Post-Katrina New Orleans. It's a great pleasure to welcome Robin Roberts and Leslie Wade to The Reading Life. As we head into the 2020 carnival season, I can't imagine a better book to read than Downtown Mardi Gras, New Carnival Practices in Post-Katrina New Orleans. And this book is written with one of our great folklorists, Frank DeCaro. Beyond the fun of street performance, these writers show us the world of meaning behind the Joan of Arc parade, Skins and Bones, Red Beans, Chewbacca's, T-Rex, the Amazons, and the Black Storyville baby dolls. Boy, what a list that is. So Robin and Les, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. We're happy to be here.
Now, this is a scholarly book, to be sure. Both of you are professors at the University of Arkansas. And you were formerly at LSU, but it's wildly accessible and entertaining for the average reader like myself. So talk about how this all began. What was your inspiration?
Well, it really started with Frank DeCaro's article where he wrote about Red Beans and Joan of Arc. That was in 2010 in Louisiana Miscellany. And he wrote that then, and then there were more and more crews. And I think at last count, there were 48 new walking crews. So our book is just a sample. And we just kept going to them, and we kept thinking, somebody needs to document this.
And I would say that we were close to the recovery experience and felt our hearts drove us to participate. And we participated in many of the things we write about. And so it was a scholarly opportunity to do something very personal. And so it was our intent to try to sort of like thread the needle in doing a scholarly work, which would also bring a wider audience.
Oh, of course. You do come to carnival from the point of view of participants. Now, Robin, I have ridden on a float with you.
Yes. Can we mention muses
yes,
in the
air?
Yes,
we can mention that.
Yes. Well, there are many parts of carnival, and of course, downtown parades are wonderful, but so are uptown parades.
Yes.
And we did find that a lot of people participate in all of carnival. It's different. The experiences are different, but they are all wonderful.
So there are many pictures, not just of other people, but of you,
yes.
Which is great. Now, one of the things that was so interesting to me was that so many of these crews spring from a single person's obsessive interest in something and determination and ability to communicate mm-hmm. that interest and make people see the possibilities in it. So talk about some of those individuals.
Well, it takes a vision. And so we could start with Amy Kirk de Voisin, who founded Joan of Arc, which is, if you haven't been to it, it's a must-see parade. It's really amazing. All of the parades are great, but it's a wonderful way to start carnival. And it's January 6th, so it's right here to go see Joan of Arc. We highly recommend it. So Amy Kirk de Voisin had the vision. But one aspect of our book that I think is important is that it starts with one really determined person with a unique vision. But to make it happen takes a community. And that community has to grow over time for the parade to flourish. So with Joan of Arc, Antoinette D'Alteris and Amanda Helm jumped in, and they're actually called the three A's that run the Joan of Arc parade, and they do many activities throughout the year. But of course, Red Beans was Devin DeWolf's vision. And T-Rex was sort of a group of people. And Diane Honoré is a force of nature in founding not one, but two. She's a well-known culture bearer in our city. So somebody has to have the vision, but then the rest of the city has to jump in and not only participate, but also be the audience. There's not a successful parade without an audience.
Now, Les, you're a professor of theater.
Right.
So talk about the performance aspects of this. I mean, in Joan of Arc, for example, there's so many complicated performances.
I would just say generally that New Orleans has one of the world's great theaters, and it's Theater of the Street. Mm-hmm. And when we were doing research, I came across this phrase, which was inspiring to me. A writer was talking about post-Katrina activity and noted hope-driven creativity. And that phrase, to me, sort of has fueled these activities, that sort of in response to loss and hurt and trauma, that the response was to put forth beautiful, theatrical, sort of like kinetic art pieces. And Marty Clark Gerke, who is the founder and leader of Skins and Bones, is herself a visual artist and had tried to blend sort of Day of the Dead imagery with second line performance practices to create a new amalgam and a different, you know, a unique performance experience. And Ryan Ballard with Chewbacca's, who himself is a very accomplished and he explores various art forms. He had spent time in his Contrita exile in the West and had experiences with the Burning Man Festival and wanted to bring that back to New Orleans. And so what could you do, again, with that sort of synthesis of performance styles, which, again, brings up questions regarding testing the boundaries of carnival and how do those who hold more closely to traditional practices, how do they regard all of these new ventures and new testings of possibility?
I love that phrase, hope-driven creativity. That's beautiful. That's a whole damn city.
You know, what
well,
do you think
Susan,
about?
I could add to your question about founders. David Rowe, who founded the Société des Champs-Élysées, their route, their streetcar is gone, but they are going to still parade on Rampart Street as a walking crew this year. And so, again, you create a new crew and a terrible tragedy occurs, but you are still going to parade.
Right.
Also on January 6th. So that's another issue, too, is there are so many parades, you can't be in two places at once, but that is also a fun parade.
Yes. Now, one of the other things that I think is interesting is that these crews have taken on community involvement component, philanthropic sometimes. And I look at the way Joan of Arc has taken on an educational aspect as well, which is so important, don't you think?
Yes, I agree. And each crew seems to choose something that's appropriate for what the crew does. So selecting a young woman to be Joan of Arc and have essay contests and also to celebrate French culture. Joan of Arc also has a one-day conference every year that is just an exciting opportunity. And it's open to the public, like our book. It's an attempt to do outreach and to educate people. David Rowe and the Champs-Élysées crew, they feed people at St. Mark's and in other venues. And so there are lots of examples of that kind of, it comes from the heart philanthropy. It's really connected
right.
to, and it's also a way for the group to get together throughout the year. Almost all of the people we interviewed stressed it's not just the one day, it's not just the parade. It's a really important community group of supporters and friends.
Well, that's the great thing about Carnival. I mean, it's like we make it all year long. And there's a moment, you can usually feel it when it sort of kicks into high gear, but it is a devotional practice for
yes.
so many people, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, I would cite Linnell Thomas, who has, I think, written very eloquently about tourism and the way the city sort of postures itself regarding outsiders. And Carnival is a great draw. And I think that she gives advice that, to me, I take heed, that I think these carnival activities provide immense joy and great fun, but one just doesn't get lost in the thrall of the performance. But with that comes sort of a community commitment, sort of the boots on the ground change. There are, you know, things in New Orleans, long-term issues that need addressing, that it's not just an activity of play or through the play, sort of different material needs can be met or changes can be brought. So I really think of downtown Mardi Gras as being a very progressive, forward-looking enterprise that helps to build relationships and to open up new possibilities, even sort of aspirant possibilities as to what New Orleans could be, a better New Orleans.
We're here with Robin Roberts and Leslie Wade, who along with Frank DeCaro are the authors of Downtown Mardi Gras.
We'll talk a little bit about Skins and Bones, which is so rooted in our culture these days.
Skins and Bones started as sort of a supplemental activity to the Wild Chapatulas as a drum entourage, and it began to embrace the practice of Northside Skull and Bones Gang, getting out in the morning and haunting the neighborhood and rattling on doors, etc. Now, it's developed more and more into like a very finely honed women's drum corps. So it has evolved over time. But I think it brings up an issue of sort of the interface between traditional Black culture and new practitioners, in this case, performers with a feminist commitment. And to their credit, I think they have made very successful attempts at building relationships so that rather than any kind of adversarial relationship, that it's been one of mutual support, recognition, and honor given to the traditional practices.
And not honoring the traditional practices so much is T-Rex. But it does.
Some of the people in T-Rex talk about making shoebox floats when they were children.
Yes.
So it comes back to that tradition. But certainly they are having fun with the original Rex. And as we talk about in our book, there were some legal discussions about the use of the name. And there's a funny spelling of T-Rex because of that. But it was, as Nancy Dixon and Bill Lavender and Claudia Lynch talk about, a response to Mardi Gras getting too big and the floats getting too huge. And so wanting to have the artistry and the hands-on technique. And many of the people in T-Rex, like Dana Embry, Claudia, are artists. And so the floats are beautiful. They may be small, but they're spectacularly beautiful. And they're also lit up now. But
I know. I love that. And you have to get up close.
That's right. You have to get up. It's very personal experience, T-Rex. And I think that shows there's room for the tiny floats and the super cruise, all being part of Carnival's range of creative expression.
Well, so much of what has come about recently is about female empowerment. And I think of Amazons and what they add to this celebration.
Yes.
There's a very deep layer of meaning there for these women. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, the Amazon started with Diane Honoré experiencing breast cancer and deciding to be positive and to reach out to other survivors. So it is very much, as you mentioned, philanthropic. Money is raised for local breast cancer survivors. But it's also, as Diane says, I think very movingly, that there's nothing braver than, you know, having breast cancer surgery and being out in the street marching and parading and waving a sword around.
It's a real sword,
very empowering. So I think that is just another way. Again, the Amazons is not just about Mardi Gras, but they participate in their own parade and also in Joan of Arc. So there's nice overlap with some of the crews that we ended up featuring in our book.
And Diane is in Amazons. She's in Red Beach.
Yes.
She's a baby doll.
That's right.
She's your utility player for Mardi Gras.
Well, she has the skill set. It's very important to be able to create your own costumes if you want to be in this many parades. And she does a beautiful job and helps others to create costumes too. So that art form, I think, is really important. And she represents, again, sort of the range, because Black Storyville Baby Dolls is also drawing on an older tradition and reclaiming it for, you know, the current time. And those outfits are beautiful spectacular, too.
In October, we recently had a very beautiful event where there was a march to Bayou St. John, and flowers were spread on the waters in a commemorative act. And it was very touching, and like what you're saying, that it kicked in on a lot of different levels. And I was introduced to this by Robin, and I will just say that I'm now a drummer. And have enjoyed that immensely in my time as an Amazon. Oh, well, I'm not an Amazon.
You're a Scythian. Right. Scythian. But Lynette Johnson is sort of the leader of the drum crew, and there are some wonderful drummers. And that, of course, is part of New Orleans' musical tradition, to have drumming and certain kinds of beats as you march in the streets. So it's very empowering.
Absolutely. My house is full of drums, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, maybe you'd like to be a Scythian.
I don't know. I don't know. So talk about your participation in Carnival, both of you. What else do you do?
Robin has had much wider experience, many, many years in Muses. And that has sort of opened the door through relationships. And I think that's something to really underscore. So much of this is relationship driven, and that I think a lot of people in the community, especially those new to New Orleans, want these relationships and seek these opportunities to be in these performances. So we have more recently been participant in this. Again, it points to sort of the proliferation of the walking crews and how Carnival almost isn't large enough now to contain all of it. The crew of Krampus, which we have been taught to say Krumpus, but we now participate in that. So it's like having a little Mardi Gras the first week in December when you celebrate Christmas.
A scary little Mardi Gras.
Right.
Well, I think in some part our book is an attempt to explain to a few people in Louisiana. When I moved here and I went to my first Mardi Gras, I was absolutely beside myself. I loved it. And I guess I came back and was a little too enthusiastic for some of my colleagues at LSU. And one said, oh, you'll get over it. Well, I'm not over it. It's, you know, going into the third decade of celebrating Mardi Gras. And I think, you know, it just speaks to a part of your heart to do that. And as we've been in Arkansas, and I'm originally from the Northeast, people don't understand about Mardi Gras. And my hope is that our book will explain to them it's not what they see on TV, that it is a really rich folkloric tradition, cultural tradition. And it's very meaningful. It's very, as you've said, very has a lot of deep meaning and significance.
Yeah. And two, I would add that it's very much grassroots in its origin. And it pretty much is citizens performing for citizens. And so I think the local aspect is really important, as opposed to the parades that come down Canal. And downtown Mardi Gras sort of sees itself positioned in, I guess, friendly opposition to the old line crews that march sort of again with more of an elevated posture versus the rubbing shoulders in the street environment of downtown Mardi Gras.
So what was it like to work with Frank on this book? Because he's such an expert on Louisiana culture and folklore, and he's been observing everything for so long and with such insight.
Well, it was a great pleasure to work with him. We went to some of the parades with him. I went to my first Red Beans crew with Frank. Les and I both did. And so he was sort of a guide. I mean, he's very good at sort of identifying and ferreting out where you should go and what you, and very early too. I think his depth of knowledge there is really helpful. And of course, he's also a very good writer. He and his wife, Roseanne Jordan, who takes photographs. We have one of her photographs in the book. They've just really documented over time and seen the changes. I think looking at folklore from the 70s to now, they've really appreciated the significance as things emerged. Frank is a wonderful scholar and a role model for us, and we were very fortunate to be his colleagues and Roseanne's colleague at LSU.
And writing a book that is so much fun, but so packed with insight, you know, it's a really, really fun book to read.
Well, we enjoyed the pictures. We had a little bit of a discussion about whether the photographs would be color, but we were very pleased that we prevailed and they were able to be reproduced in color, because Carnival is such a spectacle that you really need to see the colors of all the costumes and the festivities.
And how has this changed your perception of Carnival or life in New Orleans? As you were writing this book, you've given a lot of deep, deep thought to these things.
Well, again, I look at it as aspirational. And in theory of Carnival, there's always the question, do all of these parades simply just let off steam and then life goes back to normal and politics is just back to everyday run of the mill. And I guess I sort of hold with those that do believe in that, like, transformational germ, that if you get out on the street and mix with people, then you go back to the day after Ash Wednesday, and maybe things you see with a little different viewpoint. One of my favorite stories is from a member of Chewbacca's, self-described as a corporate type, and taking his family and mixing with artists and musicians and people off the grid. And he reported that his young daughter appreciated that and said what she had learned was not to look at people for what they have, but try to appreciate people for what they are. So I look at that as being like a takeaway from all of the fun, the glitter, the lights, you know, all of that sort of frenetic energy. But it does have that sort of transformational potential.
Absolutely.
And for me, I think, you know, I knew Muses was about female empowerment and fun and women working together, but it was sort of a revelation as we looked at downtown Mardi Gras to realize women were in such important leadership roles in the development of downtown Mardi Gras. And I owe Carolyn Ware, who did Women of Cajun Mardi Gras. And so it really turns out to be true in New Orleans also, that women are just an integral part of the creation of these new Mardi Gras parades.
Do you see any limits to downtown Mardi Gras?
Well, something that we get around to at the end of the book is that since New Orleans as a whole reaching some kind of a plateau state, and there's been comment about demographics, whether there now is an outflow as opposed to the continuous inflow. But it seems that the hunger or the desire to be in these walking crews is unabated. And so how do the crews accommodate so many folks that want to join in? And Robin can perhaps speak to Red Beans and what they have done. But the fees can be so low that really the membership can just expand. So Skins and Bones doesn't have a limit. Chewbacca's now has over 200 sub-crews with over 2,000 members. And Robin, why don't you tell about
that? Well, Red Beans, of course, has been extremely popular. And Devin DeWolf came up with, I think, a very clever solution. First, he split into the Dead Beans Parade, so Red Beans and Dead Beans. And now, this year, there's going to be a Brazilian Red Bean. So there's a third parade on the same day that all meet together. So I think part of the creativity is finding new ways to be inclusive. And I think the success of downtown Mardi Gras has taught people, if they have an idea for parade, they should just go ahead and do it. And many of them have done that. There are a lot of parades that we just, you know, simply weren't able to cover. And since we finished writing the book, I think there have been at least a dozen more new parades. So
one thing I'd also mention is that the Expanse, there have been city regulations now on sizes of parades that have sort of spoken to this proliferation, so that like captains of crews in City Hall got together, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, to limit the number of walking crews in between floats in order to reduce the size and the length of the parades. And I would just note Doug McCash for The Advocate, who's a big follower and a big backer of the walking crews, said the solution was to reduce the number of title and royalty floats.
And of course, that was for uptown. Downtown, you can just take over the streets. I mean, there's really not a limit to that. There's a lot more flexibility if you want to just have a walking parade. But we did notice with Crew of Krampus that they now have three floats. So there does seem to be a tendency as you succeed to get bigger, not just in terms of the number of people, but also in terms of your floats.
But no end to the good times.
No end to the good times. That's
We've been talking with Robin Roberts and Leslie Wade, who are two of the authors with Frank DeCaro of Downtown Mardi Gras, New Carnival Practices in Post-Katrina New Orleans. Robin, Les, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Sometimes
Sometimes words and music are a perfect match. Listen to the inspiring combination of the music of Branford Marsalis, recording as Buckshot LaFunk, and the words of Maya Angelou in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still, and his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. Leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the currents end, and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped, his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing.
Ayakata,
ayakata,
ayakutu,
ayakata,
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 ayakutu.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, historian Edward J. Branly will discuss how the New Orleans Lakefront Airport helped win the war. Tuesday, January 7th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library, 4747 West Napoleon in Metairie. That's part of the meeting of the library's World War II discussion group. The Garden District Bookshop discusses The Lost Girls of Paris by Pam Genoff, Wednesday, January 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Daniel Jose Older signs Shadow Shaper Legacy, Wednesday, January 8th at 6 at Octavia Books. And coming up later this month, the Saturday Writers Clinic for January at the East Bank Regional Library features voiceover artist Michael Zients, who will discuss the art of making an audiobook at 9:30 a.m. He'll be followed by local author Stephen Ray, who will focus on how to create characters who have depth. That's at 11 a.m., Saturday, January 18th, at the East Bank Regional Library. And One Book, One New Orleans has announced its 2020 selection, New Orleans Griot, The Tom Dent Reader, edited by Kalamu Yassalam and published by UNO Press. Put that at the top of your list for the new year. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org.